We are studying the book of Samuel. I'm on page 63, 1 Samuel 17, 12. And this is the story of David and Goliath. All of us have heard this story since our wee days when we were, our parents read these sort of stories to us, Sunday school teachers, etc. But it is a story that has some mature lessons in it for us. David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, whose name was Jesse, and he had eight sons. Ephrath was one of the linear descendants of, or linear predecessors of David and Jesse, and came from out of Caleb. There were several Calebs, and Caleb the Ephrathite is the one that is the son of Jephunneh. So, anyway, Jesse had eight sons. Jesse was old in the days of Saul and advanced in years among men. And the three older sons of Jesse had gone off after Saul to the battle. The names of the three sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, the second to him, Abinadab, and the third son, Shammah. And David was the youngest. Now, the three oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's flock at Bethlehem. Remember, David was being called in from time to time to play his guitar for Saul so that and worship God so that the demonic presence on Saul would lift. So David was one of the young men who would from time to time bear his armor, but he's also working his father's flock. And so he's back and forth. The Philistines came forward morning and evening for 40 days. And took his stand. The Philistine, he's talking about, came forward morning and evening for 40 days and took his stand. And then Jesse said to David his son, "Take now your brothers and ephah of this roasted grain and 10 loaves and run to the camp of your brothers and bring also these 10 cuts of cheese to the commander of their 1,000 and look in the well for your brothers and bring back news of them." Now, in these days, when these people were in the military, they had to provide all their own stuff, provide all their own food, they'd provide all their own weapons. We have, the way we're set up today is we have the army, and the army provides you with your chow and many, many other things, but not so. When they called these armies up, these were like militiamen, but when they called these armies up, everybody had to provide their own stuff. There was a brouhaha here a couple years ago because some of our soldiers were going on the market and buying higher-end flak jackets than the military would provide them with because they were better flak jackets. Y'all remember that. And there was quite a bit of conversation about that. So we had young soldiers whose parents were buying them equipment that was better than what the military could give them. But there's a whole, down through history, there's a whole history of this. So very often when people would go to warfare, even in days of like Napoleon or even later, we talked about the ship captains a while back, they would go in and they would basically provide for themselves at least up to a certain level. And their pay, I mean, even if you were like on a ship where they would actually feed you something, and the something might not be great, but they feed you something, your pay would actually be the booty that you collected in the field, etc., etc. So David had to go back and forth to take supplies to his brothers, including food. You know, a big army is going to run the forest out of deer pretty fast, so said, you know, that sort of thing. So Saul and all the men of Israel are in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. So David arose early in the morning and left the flock with a keeper and took the supplies and went as Jesse had commanded him, and he came to the circle of the camp while the army was going out in battle array shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines drew up in a battle array, army against army, and David left his baggage in the care of the baggage keeper and ran to the battle line and entered in order to greet his brothers. As he was talking with them, behold, the champion of the Philistine from Gath, named Goliath, the one that was referenced earlier, was coming up from the army of the Philistines, and he spoke these same words, and David heard him. When all the men of Israel saw the man, they fled from him, and they were greatly afraid. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who is coming up? Surely he is coming up to defy Israel, and it will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel."
House
Okay, I was going to cover that. He's going to make them tax-free.
Okay.
The two bennies he was offering to whoever killed Goliath was the hand of his daughter Merab, and that his family would be tax-free in Israel. Jesse also sends gift to the sons' commanders to curry favor. You know, if you're thinking about this, you want your sons' commanders to value your son and to like your son. So if he's going to send somebody in for a death mission, it'll be somebody who didn't send any fruitcake this year. Whoever killed Goliath was going to wind up with Saul's daughter, and his family would be free of taxes. David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach of Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him in accord with his word, saying, "Thus will be done for the man who kills him." Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. Eliab's anger burned against David, and he said, "Why have you come down, and with whom have you left those few sheep of yours in the wilderness? I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you have not come down in order to see the battle." David said, "Well, what have I done now? Was it not just a question?" And he turned away from him to another and said the same thing, and the people answered the same as before. So David is stunned that no one will challenge Goliath. David is young, and he has this relationship with God, and it seems only normal to him that any number of people could pick up the challenge and go out against Goliath, irrespective of how big Goliath is or how well armed he is or that sort of thing, because David is used to the idea that God leads us in victory against all odds when we walk with him, when it's in his will to do so, and that shouldn't be an issue. The men who are soldiers, the mature men who are sitting around, who are used to fighting and whatever, they're seeing that their chances against this big guy are slim and none. David, operating out of a faith and a certain naivete that drives his faith, is going, "I don't see what the problem is." Well, that irritates Eliab, his older brother, because, I mean, in effect, he's challenging the manhood of all those people there, including Eliab, his older brother. And so he just dresses him down and says, "You know, you're a boy. You've got a few sheep over there. You've come up to watch the battle because you think it's fun. You know, what do you know about something like this, twerp?"
Wait, let me see. What translation?
It's the Hebrew word twerpa. No, one thing is always true, we always see this, is that at this point in time, David's brothers don't have a clue who he is. I mean, he's just a younger kid that keeps the sheep. And, you know, that's not extraordinary, given the reality of the culture and whatever. But they don't have any sense of appreciation for his. You know, he shows up at feast days from time to time, and most of the time he's out watching the sheep like they had to until another younger brother came along and whatever. He doesn't fit in their scheme of things.
Did they all have the same mother?
Oh, yeah.
They did?
Oh, yes.
Well, you know, I'm thinking of some others.
No, that's a fair question, but yes, they do.
Oh.
No, they're all blood brothers, both sides of the family.
Okay.
But, you know, we don't have the familial connections here in the Old Testament like we have in the New Testament. In the same way, you don't see the relationship people have with their children in the Old Testament, likely because we don't have the Spirit flowing here, and that sort of thing is not as embraced by the culture. You know, people love each other. People love one another for reasons other than just because we're brothers of the same mother or whatever.
Would the brothers have been jealous of the fact that he was called up to play his instruments for the king?
Probably not. Assuming they even knew about it, I don't think so. I mean, we look at that and we say, "Oh, gee, he's in ministry." Well, to them, you know, he's just some kid playing this, you know, harp. I mean, they think of him as a pansy. He's a poet. You know, he plays the guitar.
Pansy poet with a guitar.
You know, they don't. Yeah, they don't. They're not going to look at him like he's anything. We're looking backwards with eyes that hold David up in high esteem.
Yeah.
They're mere sheep. He assumes David is going to just come up to see the battle. He neither knows nor respects his brother. David pushes back and continues to inquire about the reward, and he's surprised at the lack of faith among Saul's warriors. David has what they all lack, which is a personal relationship with God. Now, that's important for us to see. This kid is not filled with the Spirit on an intermittent basis as he is, but he doesn't have this grasp of the Holy Spirit just because he's young and naive. He has it because he has a relationship with God. And you got people with a relationship with God and people without. And there's a significant difference. And it doesn't really matter what their station in life is. You can have some little old lady who has this relationship with God, and she has more strength in her and more peace in her than someone who's got $10 million and whatever else you got, you know. Because the relationship with God is life-producing. And that's what he's got. That's what makes him stand out. That's what makes Noah stand out. He has a relationship with God. That's what makes Abraham stand out. He has a personal, intimate, conversational relationship with God. You know, that's what makes Jacob, in the long run, stand out. Joseph, there's all these brothers, and here's this kid, Joseph, who has his personal, intimate relationship with God. And even though he's drug into slavery and everything, he's lost everything he thought he was going to have, including the favor of his father and all the potential riches and all that kind of stuff. And even in slavery, he feels the need and the call to be obedient to the God who allowed him to become enslaved. That's because of that relationship. The relationship, you know, I've told people before, if you told me that Nancy was unfaithful or whatever, I wouldn't believe you. And if you brought me a picture, I'd say you photoshopped her head on it because of the relationship. Because of the relationship. And there's, you know, when you know each other really well, you know what's possible and what's not. You know what's true and what's not. And you know what you can count on and what you can't. That's the way it was. He had this relationship with God. And he just can't get over the fact that nobody... I mean, there's all these men of valor practiced in war who surely are bigger and better and tougher than he is. And it seemed like any one of them would have gone out and taken this thing on. I mean, Goliath's big, but, you know, so what? You know, David's taking on bears and he's taking on lions because God has helped him to do that. And so he thinks, you know, I remember when I was a kid, I had my little brother Mike. Mike was real small growing up, and he got a lot of favor from my parents because he was real small. Of course, we resented that, but he was a scrapper. The only fights I ever got into that were serious were the ones I got into in order to get him out of something. Because he wouldn't take anything from anybody, and he would be in their face going, you know, they would be towering over him, and he was a scrapper, and he basically worked under the theory that if I hurt him enough, even if they beat me, they'll pick on somebody else because I'm just too much trouble. He was a banny rooster. And in fact, the only time I ever saw him really get licked in a fight was by some kid who's the same size. But he mostly just made himself such a nuisance that people left. Or else I had to finish it. But one of the... which didn't always go well. But... at any rate, Mike had this self-image from the time he was really small that he was tough. And he would walk around the house in his undershorts and a pair of guns hanging down from, you know, pistols and stuff in here, and his red cowboy hat and his boots. And he'd be walking around, and, you know, and if he had a pair of shorts on, they were falling down from the gun belt, you know. And he would get in the room back in the back where we had the washer and dryer. And he would, my dad was a grocer, so we had lots of sacks. And he would open up the sacks and stack them up, and then he would systematically beat them to a pulp. He had a room full of them, and he would beat them to a pulp until they were all flattened out. And when he'd get done, he'd come out and he'd go, you know, I think me and Roy Rogers are about as tough as what is, you know. That's what he said. He thought him and Roy Rogers could handle anything. Well, David thought him and God could handle anything. When the words which David spoke were heard, they told them to Saul, and he sent for him. Now, Saul has some experience with this kid. He has a sense that there is a power in this kid, because, remember, he's been playing for him, and the demons go away. So Saul has a view of him that's bigger than a lot of people. He doesn't understand it all, but he senses something. So he sends for him. I don't think Saul's going to be sending for every teenage kid who comes into the camp and says, "Oh, I could take him," you know. So he sends for him. David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." Saul said to David, "You're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, and he has been a warrior since he was youth." I mean, this guy's 9'2", 9'4", something like that. And since he was 17, he was probably 6'2", or 7'1", and muscled out and the whole nine yards. He was built bigger from the start. Goliath, we're talking about. And he said, "This guy's been a warrior from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant was tending his father's sheep when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock. And I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth when he rose up against me. I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him." You didn't lose your sheep to anything. They were your livelihood. And you also had to account for it at home. Yes. But he's got muscle and stuff now. He's not ripped like he's going to be later. But he's through puberty and everything. He said, "The Lord will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." He's already saved me from a lion and a bear and a whole bunch of other stuff. Clothed David with his garments. And he put a bronze helmet on his head and he clothed him with his armor. So he says, "Well, let me give you my armor." And so he puts about 25 pounds worth of bronze on him. David girded his sword over his armor and tried to walk before he had not tested them. And David said, "So I can't even walk in these. I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them." David took them off and he took his stick in his hand and chose for himself five smooth stones from the brook and put them in the shepherd's bag, which he had in his pouch, and his sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. He used his staff and his slingshot that's what he fought with, or as a matter of fact. Now, you know, one thing you probably know this, but the people of this day, and the Jews in particular, and the Judeans in particular, were deadly with slingshots. I mean, remember, these people were very often given no metal with which to fight, and they had to fight with what they had. They had to hunt with what they had. And primitive cultures are all very good with slingshots and spears and stuff like that. But so this is not unusual that he would have skill here. David's trust is in God, not in any physical strength that he has personally. Come to the conclusion, kind of like my little brother, that he and God can do anything. That he and God are a majority. That if he's walking with the Lord, I mean, unless the Lord wants him to get his head handed to him, he's going to win. And if the Lord wants him to get his head handed to him, then blessed be the name of the Lord. That's what must be. So that's setting him apart from all these people is not that he was smarter or bigger or stronger, although he becomes those things as life goes on, but that he has this relationship with God. And this relationship is something he developed through all of his loneliness in the field with his sheep, all spending all this time doing something with it, and the something he chose to do with it is to talk to God and to develop his spirit. Then the Philistine came and approached David with a shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy, meaning he was red-faced, and with a handsome appearance. "You're a pretty boy. And, you know, you're all red like a newborn. Like somebody just scrubbed you down with a bunch of salt. You know, you shine, you glisten." And the Philistine cursed David. Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" Now, remember that the Jews used the term dog as a euphemism for Gentiles. And the Gentiles knew that. And so he says, "Are you treating me like a dog that you come to me with sticks?" Philistine cursed David by his gods, and the Philistine also said to David, "Come to me, I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field." David said to the Philistines, "You come to me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts." So David is declaring that his strength is in his relationship with God, and that that ought to outgun his spear, sword, and javelin any day of the week. The God of the armies of Israel, I come to you in the name of the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. In the process of taunting Israel, you also taunting Israel's God. This day the Lord will deliver you up into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you. And I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, that all the assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give it into our hands. He said, these battles are won and lost on the basis of the will of God. And we have a long history of God intervening for us. I'm sure most of y'all have seen the movie Patton. You remember that when during the Battle of the Bulge, there was horrible weather that was covering over all of this, and it kept the Allies from getting their planes in the air to, you know, push the Germans back. And there was this town just outside of Bastogne there, and it was surrounded by, it was captured by the Germans. They had it lock, stock, and barrel. But it was surrounded. But inside of this town were a bunch of Allied soldiers that couldn't get out. And the Germans were going like this. And they desperately needed to free up these soldiers, and they sent Patton in. And Patton's armies were, my dad worked for Patton. My dad hauled fuel for Patton, which is an interesting thing, because Patton moved like greased lightning. He didn't worry about it. He just expected everybody to keep up with him. And so my dad had to run fuel back and forth. And when Patton would go through an area, he wouldn't stop and clean it out. He would just break through it and move on and keep going forward. And there would be all these like snipers and then other small troops and squads still in the area. So my dad's driving fuel, truckloads of fuel, and he would get to certain places where they knew the snipers were, and he would, they had these trucks that had no doors on them, and so he would put the throttle on these trucks. Old trucks used to have throttles. You could pull up something and it would just keep going at 20 miles an hour. The ones I learned to drive on were like that. And so he would put the throttle on, and then he would get out beside the truck and steer it this hand and has Tommy gun this hand, because if these guys decided to blow up the back of that truck, he wanted as much space as possible between him and all that. So anyway, he was following Patton, and Patton was going like lightning. Well, he got to this town, and the weather would not provide him with the air cover that he needed in order to be able to successfully disperse all of these Germans. So he calls for the chaplain. And Patton had this really embedded belief that he had God on his side. He had this. He was sometimes supernatural to the point of believing all kinds of stuff. But he had this deeply embedded belief that God, that no one could hurt him, because God had him. So he called this chaplain to him, and he said to him, "You know, you're a captain in the army, and here's what I want you to do. I want you to write a prayer that will cause God to cause this weather to go away." And he said, if you write the right kind of prayer, then it'll work. If you don't, it won't. And you know, it's kind of like this: you're gonna get more or less battle stars based on this prayer. You know, Nancy's father was given battle stars for his cooking, because he was a cook on a ship, and he really did a good job, and so they gave him stars for that. So, you know, this chaplain's job was to write the right prayer. And so the chaplain said to him, I'm not sure exactly how to feel about this. You're asking me to write a prayer so that we'd ask God that he would clear up the sky so we can kill our fellow man. And Patton said, I have an enormous relationship with God in heaven, and if you write the right kind of prayer, he'll hear it. You'll hear my prayer. And so the guy came back with a prayer, and Patton read the prayer. The sky cleared up, the planes came, and Patton delivered this. This was the place, for instance, where the German general had asked the American general inside the city to surrender, and his answer was nuts. You know, you remember this in history. His answer was nuts, and when all the world people got excited about it. I mean, everybody knew, and you know, Chicago, Illinois, they knew that this town was surrounded, that American troops were there, and that it was dire. So David believed that his relationship with God was such that if God told him to go fight this guy, there'd be no problem. So it happened when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. David put his hand in his bag and took from it a stone and he slung it and he struck the Philistine on his forehead. The stone sank into his forehead so that he fell on his face to the ground, knocked him out. Kind of like that lady on the eighth hole in Phoenix yesterday who got hit by Jay Haas's golf ball. Pong! She flew up in the air and went straight down. It was sad. She's all right. She's fine now, but she was down and out for the count. Thus David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and he struck the Philistine and killed him, but there was no sword in David's hand. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. Now this sword was probably about as big as David was, because Goliath's sword was enormously long. Somewhere it's referenced somewhere about its length. You know, but in fact, later on, in when David's a grown man and he's fleeing from Absalom, he goes to the priest at Nob, where the sword is being kept, and they give it to him, and it becomes the sword he uses for the rest of his life, Goliath's sword. So when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled, and the men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the valley, and to the gates of Ekron, and the slain Philistines lay along the way to Shaaraim, even to Gath and Ekron, and the sons of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their camps. And then David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put the weapons in his tent. Well, we know they didn't stay there. David goes out boldly to confront Goliath, the giant Goliath, but Goliath claims that David's youth and his apparent lack of military skills will cause him to lose. Goliath thinks he's being toyed with and disrespected. I think I've covered that. But David makes it clear that the battle and therefore the victory is God's. David runs toward Goliath while launching the stone with a sling. We covered all that. When we know that God is with us because our relationship is right with Him, and we know and we can talk over every scenario and situation, then we can live in the firm confidence that we will have success. Many years ago, I was mid-level manager. Nobody much would give me a good job, and I was sort of destined to be like my father, which is work all the days of my life at some mid-level management job or whatever. And my new boss came through, and he had heard good things about me, because when he came to the company, he spent the first month riding out in the field with the guys who were actually doing the work out in the field, and he'd ask them all about, you know, corporate office and whatever, and they'd say, well, if you want something done, you need to give it to Wayne. Or call Wayne and he'll help. That's because we had a company who had not yet made any money. It was controlled and, you know, by the accounting department and every penny and whatever. And I had been in the field, so I knew how that worked. And they knew that I'd been in the field, so they'd call me and then I'd find some way to work through the morass in there to get them whatever it is they needed. And these companies, when they're young, they do that. They're controlled by accounting. It wasn't until John came along later and got the company on the right footing that it began to be more driven and led by sales and marketing. But that's how mature companies work. So he had heard good things, and so he began to give me tasks to perform. He believed that I could do that. He would tell me, you can do this. And when he started doing that, he started handing me tasks that were larger than any I'd ever had before. There were tasks that I would like to try on, but they were bigger than any I ever had. And we had a relationship that went like that for years. I went to a meeting with him in Vegas one year, and it was the first time I'd ever been there, and it was a meeting that they had going, and it was some moving parts and pieces and whatever. And John said, next year this is your meeting. You're going to do this meeting next year. So he did this, and I would get to the place where I would go and sit down before the Lord, and I would say, now God, if you don't help me, I'm dead. If you don't help me, I'm dead. And that was a regular prayer for me. I remember when I was a bill collector years before all of that. You know, I was a very sort of a wimpy person. I was not very, I'm not like I am now in the sense of being bold and brash and whatever. I was polite. I was raised to be a nice boy. And the idea of calling people up and asking them to pay their bills, the job God designed for me to put metal in me. And it was not easy. I mean, Nancy would tell you, I would come home at night sweating. And whenever things got really bad, I would go to the men's room, get in a stall, and pray. I mean, literally, I would go up there and I would pray to the Lord and I'd say, God, if you don't help me, I'm dead. I remember going to these people, the people who were training me, and they had no idea how scared I was. And they said, now, you know, if you're going to be any good at this, you got to lie. You got to tell them, you know, that you're the buddy from the army and you're looking for so-and-so. And all, you know, you got to be able to do this. Or you got to be able to yell and scream at them or whatever. We had these guys who, you know, they not only did they yell, but they would take the phone and they would ring it around the metal garbage cans. The metal round garbage, they'd ring it around and make this horrible noise in people's ears. Some of them, their phone was pointed almost because they had done this so much. And they were telling me, this is how you have to do this job. And I was going, I can't do this. This is not the way, this isn't right. I can't lie. I can't do this. And so I finally came to the conclusion that what I needed to do was to trust the Lord. So I laid hands. Every month you had a box like this, and there was these files, and the files, and it was all full of people who were 90 days past due or more. And so you would get these files for the month, and then you would collect them down to this far, and the next month your box would fill back up. And usually it was the same people from last month because they were supposed to get 90 days, but you get one payment, and then you had to deal with them again come January, come the first of the next month. So I got to, you know, this was total, I mean, God had me way out in the water over my head. So I said, I laid my hands on these, and I said, God, please bless these people so that they can pay me, and me before somebody else, you know, just bless them, okay? And so then I began to call them up, and I was not mean or rude, and I didn't lie to them, whatever, you know, and various things. Well, the result was, is that my, you know, I got this thing down, this file down to 0.4%. Never been done in the company before. This is General Electric Credit Corporation. They'd never had anybody collect down that low. And it was because God was blessing these people, and they liked me, and they were sending me money, and some of them were paying up, and some of them were finding money and paying off. And, I mean, this went on for months and months and months until finally they sent somebody down from Chicago to investigate because they assumed that I was sort of hiding money here and there or moving money around, that I was finagling this because it was too low. And so they came down, they did their investigation, and they found out I wasn't finagling it. These people were actually doing this. And so they, instead of firing me, they offered me a promotion to go to Chicago and gave me a dinner down at the Kunz's, the Dutchman, which was the, you know, thing.
But did you tell them God was doing it?
Yeah.
What was the reaction to that?
We don't care, son, whatever your method is, you know, they don't care. I didn't say the Lord's blessed me, you know, or whatever. So, at any rate, you know, my boss was so appreciative, they gave him a watch. And so he offered to sell his old watch to me for half price, because he was really grateful. So, at any rate, so I had this history of, you know, like, the next thing that happened was, is God put me in this place where I was the foreman of a factory, and I'd never been in a factory in my life, and I was, all of a sudden, its foreman. And it was in deep financial trouble, and we were making windows and doors, you know, the kind you, storm windows and storm doors, awnings, patio covers. I walked in, college education, I'm the foreman. Everybody there made it through the eighth grade if they were lucky, and they'd been in the business for 20 years. And so, you know, the last thing they wanted was to listen to somebody like me. So I walked in and I said, God, I'm dead. If you don't help me, I'm dead. And, you know, he's going to you again. You know, I mean, it's a... And God blessed it, and it worked itself out. And there's story after story after story like this. So then when I ran into John, he had confidence in me, so he would give me these tasks. And I went from being, you know, I don't know what I was, to the director of sales administration, which was a job that I had invented that he gave me. And then he made me the VP of operations of the whole company. And so I went like that really fast, and And every, it's like every time I turn around, I was going, God, if you don't help me, I'm dead. Because he would go, you could do it, John. You can do this. You know, you can do this. And God would just meet me. And so what happened is it sort of projected me, and I got into this whole area of being an upper management, and I would have never got there if God hadn't sent somebody along to do this. But the process of getting there pushed me way outside my comfort zone and way above my head. And if John hadn't believed that I could do it, if he hadn't insisted that I could do it, that would have hurt. I don't know if I could have done it. But he insisted that I could, and so I said, God, if you don't help me, I'm dead. I can't tell you how many times I've been in situations of one kind or another and said, God, if you don't help me, I'm dead. If you don't help me, I'm a total failure here. Because I would keep getting put in these positions. You know, it's kind of like my dad used to say that a proper reward for a job well done is another job. Well, that's where John used to come from. Well, great, you did this, you conquered this, here's another mountain. You know, could we bask in this one for a minute? Nah, you need to go on. So what happened is in a very practical way, the Lord put me in a situation where in order to survive, I had to depend on him. And it's a great place to be in. And what happened is after it happened 10 times, 15 times, or whatever, I began to count on it happening. I began to believe that it happened. So when someone said, okay, I want you to go and figure out how to solve this problem, you know, I would always start off with the standpoint of, I can't do it. Whatever. But the point is that we need to get ourselves in a position where we're saying to the Lord, Lord, if you don't help me, I can't do this. If you don't come and support me, I will fail. It will crash. Because it's beyond me. But you are, O Lord our God. You know the thing we've talked about. Well, that's where David was. The surprise victory terrifies the Philistines. Now, Goliath is out in front of this huge army, much bigger than Israel. And these are warriors that are much better fighters than Israel. It wasn't that long ago that these people had been, you know, had Israel totally under their thumb. Saul has been king now for, I don't know, maybe 15 years or something like that. And they're just getting around to getting weapons for everybody. And so here they are. They've got their Goliath out there, and they're all full of themselves because Goliath is up there standing. And when Goliath goes down, their power over Israel hasn't changed a bit, but their heart melts. And they go, oh my God, they killed the champion. And they get fearful, and they flee. And one of the things that God does all the time in the Bible when he wants to defeat some larger group is he makes them fearful or causes them to be confused. He takes away their peace. And in doing so, he reduces a much larger group of people to shreds for the sake of a much smaller group of people who will trust him. You all remember Indiana Jones, the Raiders of the Lost Ark, and how Hitler was looking for this ark because he thought of it as this glorious weapon because he'd studied the occult and he knew this was true. And they were looking for this weapon because this weapon they believed in. You know, now Hitler had what? All the tanks and everything else he needed, but he wanted this weapon because people put their faith in stuff like that. Well, if you put your faith in God, he will meet you. And what's the worst that can happen? You'll get run over by a train and go to be with the Lord now. I mean, that's really the worst that can happen.
The kids go live with your mother part, I think.
She's a Christian.
All right. Now, when Saul saw David going out against the Philistines, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, whose son is this young man? And Abner said, by your life, O king, I do not know. And the king said, well, you inquire whose son this youth is. And when David returned from the killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the Philistine's head in his hand. And Saul said to him, whose son are you, young man? He said, I am the son of your servant Jesse the Bethlehemite. All right, it's a good beginning. Now, it came about when he had finished speaking to Saul that the son of Jonathan was knit, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as himself. Now, we talked before about the fact that the idea of familial love as we know it today was not as developed in the old world, and sometimes you had people who love their sons or daughters, some of them and not others, and, you know, whatever. And but we have a lot of love stories in the Bible. And some of them are between people like David and Jonathan, or Ruth and Naomi. In other words, they're same gender people who love each other deeply. And there's absolutely nothing in the Bible anywhere that prohibits one man from loving another with all of his heart. There's nothing in the Bible that prohibits any one woman from loving another with all of her heart. The issue that we run into today with this whole controversy on homosexuality is not whether someone loves someone or not. Because the Bible gives us examples. John was the beloved disciple of Jesus. They were very close and they loved each other. Nothing wrong with that. The issue has to do is what is the purpose of human sexuality, and what is it that God says we are to do with it or not do with it? That's the issue. So when someone says, well, gee, I love that person. Well, you know, congratulations. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. That's a good thing. What they're trying to say is well, you are trying to tell me I can't love that person, and everything in me wants to love that person. No, I'm not telling you can't love that person. I'm just telling you, like you would every other man, woman, and child on the face of the earth, that God has created sexuality for one thing and has rules on how it's to be used, and He's God. That you can control, whether you love somebody or not. I mean, I may love somebody, you know, Susie Q, to death, but I can't have sex with her because I have a commitment here. I mean, honestly, I just may love her to death. She may just be precious to me. But that is, you see what I'm saying? So when we get in all these controversies about homosexuality and lesbian and all this kind of stuff, one of the things we need to realize is there's no prohibition anywhere in the scriptures that says that one person cannot love somebody of the same gender with all of their heart. Because we see examples of people like that. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, it's been interesting to see people in the modern day try to make a homosexual relationship out of David and Jonathan. When Jonathan is slain later on in the story, David, the guy with the guitar and the poetry, he gets out and he writes this madrigal poem about Jonathan. And he says in this poem, I loved you more than the love of women. I loved you more than any woman I've ever known. And moderns try to make something out of that, like there was this homosexual relationship between David and Jonathan, because of the way David's expressing his love and the way Jonathan's expressing his love toward each other. But there's nothing to suggest that at all. It's because people make this erroneous connection between love and sex, that if you love somebody, it therefore gives you the right to have sex with them. Because they make this erroneous connection, they make these kinds of jumps. I think you'll find, if you get that in your mind, that it'll help you in dealing with the whole issue of human sexuality. Because one of the things that we have a hard time with is, even though we say, well, we don't believe in homosexuality, we don't believe it's a valid lifestyle, but we have a hard time coming down on somebody who says, but I love that person. Like, what's wrong with that? I was born to love that person. Well, you know, if we'll disconnect those two things and realize they don't connect, it'll help us. Fine, love that person, you know. But sex is a gift. God's designed it. He has rules for it. And that has nothing to do with whether you love that person or not. All right, so Jonathan's soul was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself. Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house. So David's not going back to keep sheep anymore. Now he's been drafted into Saul's army, and his sheep keeping days are over. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan said to him, my heart is knit to yours, and I will lay down my life for you, and may God do more to me and such to me and more if I ever depart from that. Now, there is a covenantal principle called Mizpah. And Mizpah is usually symbolized by two hearts, by a heart cut in half. So you go into the mall and you'll see a thing hanging there, a chain, it's a half a heart. And maybe you'll see one of each half and it'll say him and her or something like that. And Mizpah, it's become a symbol of love between two people. And so we use it that way You know, sweetheart gives it on Valentine's Day. Okay, gives them half a heart. Well, Mizpah is actually a curse. What happened, where Mizpah comes from, is because Laban, who was chasing down Jacob to kill him, caught him at Mizpah. And when he caught him there, God told Laban, you cannot say anything, you cannot come against Jacob, whatever. And so Jacob and Laban, much against Laban's will, made a covenant, because God forced him to, that Jacob would care for his wives and his children and not marry anybody else so as to dilute their inheritance. Because remember, legally, the wives and the children belong to Laban. And so they belonged to Laban, because in those days when you married into somebody's family, then you became part of that family. Remember when the sheep were taken and the daughter said, the sheep are ours and therefore we'll take them with us because they're our inheritance. So Laban put they made a covenantal agreement that Jacob would handle his daughters, their maids, and these children a certain way legally. Legally, and they agreed to that covenantally, and then they called this curse down upon themselves, called Mizpah. And it says, if I ever violate this covenant, may what has been done to this heart be done to us. Now, the way that covenants were done was they would take an animal and cut it in half, and the people would walk through it. And they would say, if I ever break this covenant, may whatever's been done to this animal be done to me. I give you permission to come and kill me if I break this covenant. In fact, the verb for making a covenant is berith. It means to cut a covenant. Well, Mizpah is the curse that comes down upon people that says, if you ever break this agreement, may I be dead. You know, you can kill me. So this covenantal relationship here between Jonathan and David and others that we'll see like this, is one person, you know, says to another, my life is yours, and I will give my life for you, and I will put you ahead of me. And we're going to see that Jonathan does, that he does. Take it seriously? Apparently not. I mean, you know, the brothers didn't go around looking at him like in awe or anything, obviously. Yeah. So I don't know what his mom and dad thought. But whatever it was, you know, it was future, because this is this is like Bonnie Prince Charlie, you know, comes to the throne at age 8, you know. So I don't know. Certainly his brothers didn't. Who knows what people thought. Actually, and there are probably not a lot of people who really understood what he was doing. I mean, you can anoint people as a blessing for a lot of reasons. Not like there's microphones up here and he's going to get a whole theater full of stuff there. Just a bunch of people over behind the dinner table getting some kid wet with oil, you know. Entering, Jonathan made a covenant, David, and because he loved him as himself. Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and he gave it to David. And his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. He gave him his weapons of war. He gave him the best that he had. He just said, you know what? You're my man. And he gave him his life. People cut covenants in this life, sometimes without realizing it. But one person says to another, it's you and me. We're in this together. It's always you and me. We'll always be together. You know, no matter what happens, you've got my back and I've got yours. And that's the covenantal relationship. And that's the kind we're supposed to have with God. That's how it's supposed to be. So, you know, maybe if you can look in your own experience and see who maybe in your own world fits that description, and then try to apply that to your relationship with God, it'll give you a bit. You know, the one that God uses all the time is the marriage relationship. He's constantly referring, you know, to that. In fact, when we get done, we got a long way to go in Samuel. But if we get done with Samuel and we decide what to do next, before we do anything, I want to do Song of Solomon. because Song of Solomon is an extraordinary, special book in the Bible, but it takes a class that will respect it. But it has a powerful message to it. And this class, I think, can handle it. So, I know it can. So, it speaks to this whole thing about this relationship, this love relationship. So Jonathan gives him the coat off his back, his sword, his everything, his armor, his belt. So David went out whenever Saul sent him, and he prospered. Now, one of the things that's happening is now that David's going out, he's going out wearing Jonathan's armor. And the people are used to responding to Jonathan's armor. So when Jonathan gives David this sort of approval thing, even though David's got this reputation of having killed Goliath, well, that's a one-off, right? I mean, maybe he got lucky. But when David's going out now, he has the total esteem and support of the son of the king. And everybody loves Jonathan. One of the things we see in his reading is everybody loves Jonathan. They don't like Saul much, but they love Jonathan. And they'll die for Jonathan. So when Jonathan gives him that stamp of approval and he says to him, you're valid, it makes him valid in front of everybody. It's just like John did with me. He said, you're valid. And it makes me valid in front of everybody. And that's what happens. Now, when the Lord adopts us as his children, he's saying to us, you're valid. You're mine. You're my son. You're valid. And therefore, go and behave as you would the son of a king. Go and behave as you would as a person who's noble. Go and behave as you would to represent me well. Because you're valid. Don't feel, you know, Paul had to talk to Timothy about the fact that Timothy was still timid and fearful, even though Paul had raised him up and anointed him and set him in leadership. And Timothy was still wringing his hands and unsure of himself and timid about doing things. And so when he sent him to Corinth, Timothy didn't have the inner power to deal with Corinth. And so Paul had to send Titus, because Titus did. But Timothy needed to hold sense that he had been validated. And that's something that he had to get a hold of. We can only trust that he eventually did. But that's what Jonathan has done. He's validated David. You know, James says the power of life and death is in the tongue. And one of the things we talk about that, he says that the ship is huge, but it's led by a little rudder. And he said a forest is huge, but it can be destroyed by a little match. And he said, life and death is in the power of the tongue. And one of the things that means is we have to be careful what we say. Because by what you say, you can validate somebody or invalidate somebody. So if you tell your child he's an idiot all of his life, you shouldn't be surprised when he acts like an idiot. Or if you tell them that, you know, if you encourage them, they'll grow in strength and you know, that sort of thing. We have, you know, it's like you get up in a theater and you're on fire. You've killed three people. I mean, the power of life and death is in the tongue. I'll tell you a story, a mistake Nancy and I made early on. Jenny was really good in school. They were twins. Todd and Jenny were twins. And Jenny was really good in school. And Todd had to work at it a little more. And we used to say to them, you know, because Jenny was stellar and he was good, but he wasn't stellar. And he would feel bad about it. And we would say, but Todd, you're the athlete and Jennifer's the scholar. And we said that, okay? And we thought, well, that's good. You know, we made him feel good about it and whatever. And then as time went on, we began to see that Todd had faith in being an athlete. And Jenny had faith in being a scholar, but neither one of them had faith in being any other thing. And so we had to stop and undo all that. We had to get them together and say, look, we said this and this was wrong. Todd, you're as smart as Jenny is, and you can get this, and you're whatever, and Jenny, you can do athletics. So Jenny had this sort of reputation as kind of a klutz and whatever, because, you know, but we spoke it into her. Well, you know, after that, Jenny went out and started playing powder puff football. She went out for, in Texas, high school bands are bigger than some colleges. 250 pieces were in Jennifer's band, and they won state 3 years, okay? And Jennifer did flags and rifles. And she, you know, she had to flip and do all this kind of stuff. And, I mean, it was in military precision and all this sort of thing. And when she was in the process of learning all that, she was black and blue all over up and down her arms and face and whatever from hitting herself and all that kind of stuff, learning to do all that. But she did it. And they were good. I mean, I remember one year they won with the piece from Phantom of the Opera. And the next year they won with a piece from Silverado. And they would come out and those flags would be flying and doing all this kind of stuff and the rifles would be going and whatever. It was amazing to watch. And if we hadn't told Jennifer, look, we were wrong, you're as athletic as he is, you can do this too, we would have condemned her to being a brilliant klutz for the rest of her life. And we got a hold of him in time because Todd eventually became a good scholar. And he's got a lot of confidence in his ability to learn all that kind of stuff. But we messed it up at first by speaking into them the wrong thing. Just an example. So David goes out and he prospers. And Saul set him over the men of war. Now there's a big task. Mary Wayne, I want you in charge of the army. Oh, good. It was pleasing in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. It happened as they were coming, when David returned from killing the Philistines, that the women came out of the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul, with tambourines and with joy and musical instruments. And the women sang as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his ten thousands. Oops. Trouble here. Then Saul became very angry, for this saying displeased him, and he said, they have ascribed to David ten thousands, but to me they have ascribed thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? Remember, Saul's got this emotional problem. We've seen this before. And Saul looked with David at suspicion from that time on. He began to be jealous of him. I think I covered most of the topography there.
Wayne,
yeah.
Remember the story with Miss Pat calling the church?
Oh.
She reminded me of this.
Yeah.
Sort of...
Yeah. You want to tell that story? Well, what happened is, it's kind of long. Let's not tell that story. We'll do some more.
Huh? You
got to
tell the story.
All right. I'll just blunt it down a little bit. What happened was, is that when I was teaching here in Genesis, Revelation, whatever, there was a number of people in the class that began to say nice things about me and hold me in high esteem, whatever, that happens. I know better, but it happens, okay? And so this is one lady, Pat Anderson. She was a sweet gal. And she just loved me. She, you know, whatever. And so I had this ongoing discussion with the pastor of the church. And he was telling me, now look, you know, you're getting a lot of a following here. And I want to be clear that you're not an official pastor in this church. And he said, I want you to tell them you're not an official pastor in this church because I don't want them to think that you represent the church, you know, whatever. And that was fine with me. I had no intention of going there, but he was nervous about it. So at any rate, so it was an issue. So I assured him that I would make it perfectly clear that I wasn't a pastor in the church and just a layman. And, you know, what is it they say? The opinions expressed here are not necessarily those of the management. Okay. So one day, we were on vacation, and Pat Anderson is not feeling well. So she calls up to the church, calls the church secretary, and she said, can somebody send somebody over to pray for me because Pastor Wayne's out of town? Well, I didn't hear the end of that one for a long time. You know. I didn't tell her I was the pastor. Well, she didn't, you know. So... No.
No.
No, otherwise he'd be dead.
Okay.
He finds out, but not now.
Okay.
But later. Mm-hmm. By the time he finds out, David's safe from him. We'll get there. All righty. Now it came about on the next day that an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul, and he raved in the midst of the house while David was playing the harp with his hand. And as usual, a spear was in Saul's hand, and Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, I will pin him to the wall. But David escaped from his presence twice. So Saul threw two spears at him. Now Saul was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him, but he had departed from Saul. So Saul's jealousy has now gotten chronic, and now he's trying to kill David. It's just that God had allowed, God had withheld, had pulled back his covering from Saul, which allowed the evil spirits to come against him. And, you know, God let him have him. We talked about that a couple weeks ago. Part of it is the way they treat the Hebrew. It is descriptive, not prescriptive. Therefore, Saul removed him from his presence and appointed him as commander of 1,000, and he went out and came before the people. So one good way to get rid of David is to put him in charge of a small band of soldiers and then send him out against a bigger enemy. This is a time-honored practice, and it's one that David resorts to later with Uriah the Hittite. David was prospering in all of his ways, for the Lord was with him, and Saul saw that he was prospering greatly, and he dreaded him. So as much as he tried to get David killed, David just kept being successful. All of Israel and Judah loved David, and he went out and he came in before them. In other words, they could see his coming and going because they admired him and whatever. He developed a cult following among people. Then Saul said to David, "Here is my older daughter Merab. I will give her to you as wife. Only be a valiant man and fight for the Lord's battles." So he had promised his older daughter to whoever would kill Goliath. David is now grown up from the 17 or 18 year old boy that he was. He's 22, I don't know. Whatever it is, he's old enough to take a wife. And so Saul thinks, well, I will give him Merab, and she will keep track on it. And actually he has a couple other things in mind. "For Saul thought, my hand shall not be against him, but the hand of the Philistines will be against him." So he said, "I'm going to give you my daughter, but you're going to have to go out and lead my soldiers." David said, "Who am I, and what is my life for my father's family, that I should be the king's son-in-law?" So it came about the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David. It was given to Adriel, the Meholathite, for a wife. David knew better than to take Merab in as his wife. Merab was Saul's daughter through and through. David later marries Michal, another one of Saul's daughter, but she was for David. We'll get to that. But he knew better than taking Merab. Now there's a scripture, and this is the scripture has stood me well over the many years. It's one of these proverbs. And it says, "When you sit at the table of a king, put your knife to your throat, lest his delicacies consume you." Now, what that means is that it's very easy to get into the presence of a king or some exalted person. And they're just sitting there feeding you stuff, and you're just gobbling it up, and you're just tapping, talking, chapping, whatever. Because somehow or another, you think, oh, good, I've got the favor of this king, and now I'm one of the, and whatever. And you're just running off at the mouth. And they're just picking all this up. They're listening. And this, what the proverb says is, when you're invited to sit at the table of a king, put your knife to your throat. Don't be eating all his delicacies up. And don't be focused on all that. Stay humble and keep your mouth shut. Keep your mouth shut. Because it's easy when people start speaking well of you to respond to it and get to flowing with it. But it's also dangerous. And it's usually wrong. So whenever we get into the place of someone who's exalted, our best bet is to stay humble. So he won't accept Merab. She was only going to be a spy for her father, and he knew that. So she was given to another man, Adriel the Meholathite. David later has 5 of her sons executed in a blood feud. We'll get to that later. Now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year. And David sought the presence of the Lord, and the Lord said, this that I'm getting ready to read you is the story of the 5 sons of whatever. Later on, when David is king, this is from 2 Samuel 21. There was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, and year after year, and David sought the presence of the Lord, and the Lord said, "It is for Saul and his bloody house, because he put the Gibeonites to death." So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were none of the sons of Israel, but they were the remnants of the Amorites. The sons of Israel had made covenant with them, but Saul had sought to kill them in his zeal for the sons of Israel and Judah. Then David said to the Gibeonites, "What should I do for you, and how can I make atonement that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord?" The Gibeonites said to him, "We have no concern of silver or gold with Saul or his house, nor is it for us to put any man to death in Israel." And he said to you, "Well, I will do for you whatever you say." And they said to the king, "The man who consumed us, who planned to exterminate us from remaining within the border of Israel, let 7 men of his sons be given to us, and we will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord." The king said, "I will give them." But the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, because of the oath the Lord swore between him, between David and Jonathan. So the king took 2 sons of Rizpah, daughter of Ahiah, Armoni, and Mephibosheth, whom she had born to Saul, and 5 sons of Merab, the daughter of Saul, whom she had born to Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Meholathite. He gave them the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them in the mountains of the Lord, so that the 7 of them fell together, and they were put to death the first days of the wheat harvest, the beginning of the barley harvest, and the plague ended.
Okay.
This is David's, he's the king. This is much later. He's the king. The Gibeonites are an interesting people. They were Amorites, and remember, God had told Israel to wipe out all the Amorites, and they were not to make covenant or treaty with the Amorites. And many of the Amorites tried to fight Israel and got beaten. And the men of Gibeah resorted to trickery. So they took a number of their men and they put them in really old, tattered clothing. And they gave them really moldy cheeses and stuff like that. And they had them circle around behind David and then come upon the camp. And when the people, when they came into the camp and the people caught them, this is back in the time of Joshua, "We're from a long way from here," whatever. And so Joshua didn't pray about it, and he entered into a covenant of protection with these people. And then after he had done that, they said, "Ha, ha, 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 we're from the next hill over." Okay. So what happened is that the Gibeonites were allowed to live because of the covenant that Joshua had made with them. But they were made to be hewers of wood and carriers of water. They were made to be servants. So Joshua had made a covenant in good faith with them. Later, Saul, who was trying to ingratiate himself to the Jews around the area, went in and massacred a bunch of the Gibeonites, violating the oath that Joshua had made between the Lord and the Gibeonites. And when he did that, it caused a blood feud, or it caused... God didn't like it, because God had made a covenant or pact with these people, and Saul had violated it. So... Then later on, when David is the king, there's this plague, and when he goes to pray about it, he said it's because of the blood feud of Gibeah. And so he goes to the Gibeonites to find out what he can do to get the blood feud settled. So they said, "Well, give us 7 other men, we'll hang on them, but we'll be done with it." I mean, they had slaughtered, hundreds of their people. It was a different day in those days. Today we would just sue you for everything you got. Try to put your children in the street so that they have nothing to eat. We're kinder. All right. 1 Samuel 18, back to the modern day. Now Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. And when they told Saul, the thing was agreeable to him. Merab would have been a spy for Saul, but Michal loved David. And he saw the opportunity to capture David with a daughter. You all realize that in the ancient world, that very often treaties were settled with people and hostages were taken. And they were taken in various formats. And this went on, I mean, even in more modern times. If you remember the 12th century when Henry II was king over all of England and France and whatever, even at that late date, whenever treaties would be signed, a son of the losing party would be given into the hands of the king, and if they broke the thing, then they'd hang the son. This happened all the time. Now, very often, the kings care less for the son than they did for the treaty, so they would do that. In fact, there's a couple of stories where they tricked the guy by giving him somebody who wasn't their son. They'd get some peasant kid and dress him up and, you know, out they would go. Well, the more usual way that happened was they would give their daughter as a bride to the king. that kind of hostage-taking was more usual than the one I just mentioned. They both happened. So what happened is when these kings made treaties with other nations, then one of their daughters would come and be married to the king or the king's son or whatever. And they were basically functioning as hostages. But what they also functioned as was spies for their father. So it kind of went both ways. Now remember that Solomon took 700 wives and 300 concubines because everybody in the world wanted a treaty with him. And those wives and concubines are the ones who led him astray and all that sort of thing. So Saul is thinking, if I give my daughter to David, then she will be my spy, and then that'll help me out. When they told Saul, the thing was grievous. So Saul thought, I will give her to him, and she may become a snare to him, that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Therefore, Saul said to David, for a second time, you may be my son-in-law today. Saul commanded his servants, said, speak to David secretly and say, now behold, the king delights in you and all of his servants love you. Now therefore, become this king's son-in-law. So he got a lot of people to encourage David to accept this deal. So Saul's servants spoke these words to David. David said, is it trivial in your sight to become the king's son-in-law since I am a poor man and lightly esteemed? He said, you know, I have no right to be the king's son-in-law. You know, I don't have a big dowry to give her. Haven't made my way in the world or whatever. So Saul's servant spoke these words to David. He said, okay. And the servants of Saul reported back to him according to these things that David spoke. He said he doesn't feel like he has the ability to produce a proper bride price. So he's turned it down. Now David liked Michal. There was no problem there. So Saul said to them, thus you should say to David, the king does not desire any dowry except 100 foreskins of the Philistines to take vengeance on the king's enemies. Now, it should be noticed that Philistines don't give up their foreskins lightly. Okay? And so he said to him, since you don't have money, what you can do is get me 100 foreskins of Philistines and bring them to me, and, you know, that'll take care of 100 Philistines for me. That's plenty of dowry. Okay? Now, Saul had planned to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. Somebody's got to get lucky, right? You know, there's 100 guys fighting for everything they got, and somebody's got to get lucky. When his servants told David these words, it pleased David to become the king's son-in-law. I can pay this. This is a price I can pay. I like Michal. Before the days had expired, David rose up and went, and he and his men, and he struck down 200 men among the Philistines. He thought, if 100 is good, 200 is probably better. Then David brought their foreskins, and he gave them in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. How many want to bet they didn't count them? So Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, for a wife. When Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, then Saul was even more afraid of David, because instead of her becoming his spy, she was now going to be helping him thwart her father's will. Thus Saul was David's enemy continually. The commanders of the Philistines went out to battle, and it happened as often as they went out that David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name became highly esteemed. Now Saul told Jonathan his son and all of his servants to put David to death. So the mask is off. Saul is just telling everybody, I want you to go kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, greatly delighted in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, is seeking to put you to death. Now therefore, please be on guard in the morning. Stay in the secret place and hide yourself. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are. And I will speak with my father about you, and I will find out anything I will tell you. Then Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, do not let the king sin against his servant David, since he has not sinned against you, and his deeds have been very beneficial to you. For he took his life in his hand and struck the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. He's talking about Goliath. And you saw it, and you rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without a cause? And Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan, and Saul vowed, as the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. So then Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him these words. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as formerly. So Jonathan acts as peacemaker. He restores David back into the fellowship of the king. He challenges Saul as to his unworthiness to do as he is doing. And it, so it worked itself out for a while. When there was war again, David went out and fought with the Philistines, defeated them with great slaughter. So they fled before him, and there was an evil spirit from the Lord on Saul, as he was sitting in his house with a spear in his hand, and David was playing the harp with his hand. Saul tried to pin David to the wall with a spear, but he slipped away out of Saul's presence. This is the next time, right? He's already done this once. So he stuck the spear in the wall, David fled and escaped that night. When Samuel sent messengers to David's house to watch him, then Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him in order to put him to death in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, "If you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be put to death." So Michal let David down through a window, and he went out and fled and escaped. Michal took the household god and laid it on the bed and put a quilt of goat's hair at its head and covered it with clothes. We talked about last week the fact these people were always having these idols around. When Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, "He's sick. He's a bed. He's sick." Saul sent messengers to see David, saying, "Bring to me on his bed that I may put him to death." When the messengers entered, and behold, the household idol was on the bed with a quilt of goat's hair at its head. So Saul said to Michal, "Why have you deceived me like this and let my enemy go so that he has escaped?" And Michal said to Saul, "He said to me, 'Let me go or I'll put you to death.'" Now David fled and escaped and came to Samuel at Ramah, and he told him all that Saul had done. And he and Samuel went and stayed in Naoth. And it was told Saul, saying, "Behold, David is in Naoth in Ramah." Then Saul sent messengers to take David. But when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, with Samuel standing and presiding over them, the Spirit of God became upon the messengers of Saul, and they prophesied. When it was told Saul, he sent other messengers, and they also prophesied. So Samuel sent messengers again a third time, and they also prophesied. Then he went to Ramah and came as far as the large well that is in Seku. And he asked and said, "Where are Samuel and David?" And someone said, "Behold, they are in Naoth at Ramah." And he proceeded there to Naoth at Ramah. And the Spirit of God came upon him, so that he went along prophesying continually, and he came to Naoth at Ramah. He also stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel, and lay down naked all that day and all that night, saying, "Therefore," and therefore they say, "Is Saul therefore among the prophets?" How many are you confused? Okay. When Samuel is in Ramah with his school, remember all these prophets had disciples, schools of followers. It was the disciples of Isaiah, for instance, that collected and stored his writings, the disciples of Jeremiah, disciples of Samuel. And so they're called the school of the prophets. We talked about Elisha, I think, last week, and all that, Elijah and Elisha. So one of the things that happened is when they come together for worship, the Holy Spirit falls on them. And there's this very powerful sense of the presence of the Lord. And anybody who comes into that presence of the Lord, the Holy Spirit falls on them too. And so they begin to worship and pray in tongues or whatever it is that they're doing. And they begin to act like the prophets do. And people are going, "Well, those people aren't prophets, but they're acting like the prophets do." And the reason is because they've come into the presence of the Holy Spirit. So Saul keeps sending these messengers, and when they get there, they get into the presence of the Holy Spirit, and the Spirit comes upon them, and they too join in the worship, and they're praising God, speaking in tongues, and doing all the various things, prophesying about this or that, praising God in loud voice, whatever. And the word gets back to Saul that his messengers are all prophesying. So Saul goes, "Well, I'm going to go myself." So he goes up there, and as soon as he gets within shouting distance of the place, the Holy Spirit falls on him, and he begins to tear off his clothes and go in amongst all the prophets and prophesy. And, you know, he spends the night, you know, prophesying and on whatever. And so it became an adage after that, is Saul among the prophets. And remember, this is the second time this happened to Saul. Because early on, when he went looking for his father's donkeys, remember he ran into Samuel, and the same thing happened to him there. And they said, "Is Saul among the prophets?" Because whenever they would get excited, these are Pentecostals, okay? Whenever they would get excited before the Lord, they would get down to the loincloth and go for it. They would tear off their clothes. You know, in our culture, this is somebody back there going, in those days, the women will take a spray and spray their hair and it will become stiff. They're going, "What in the world is that all about?" I promise you that anything that we do in our culture has the ability to confuse their culture. Okay. But they were after it. I guess I better quit here now.
Yeah, I think so.
See, one of the problems with reading the Bible is it always upsets the church ladies. Because the Bible does not act like we want it to. It acts like it acts. And our problem is not to judge it, but to understand it. And to see what's going on. We have to, if you've ever been to an African church, you know those folks can get after it in a pretty good way. If you go to an African American church, they can get after it in a pretty good way. And people have different cultural ways of expressing themselves for the Lord. When we were young charismatics, people used to tell us that we were acting foolish or whatever, and didn't even be shouting and praising God like we did, because we did, and we used to dance and all that sort of thing. And I loved it; it was great. But at any rate, we used to say to them, "Well, God's not nervous, but He's not deaf. God's not deaf, but He's not nervous neither. You know, He's not at all upset about the fact that we get excited before the Lord." Because down through biblical history, people got really excited before the Lord. It would wipe out one of our churches today. All right, somebody praise that.